First, may I say that we are honored by the presence of the great news gathering group, the Hearst Task Force. This is their fourth appearance before on the forum of the Commonwealth Club of California. Mr. Hearst had a little trouble remembering that because he has so many of these things to attend, but I wonder how he remembers them all at all. May I say that our first speaker will be Mr. Hearst, and he has asked me not to go into this big, long background and pedigree of his because it's very long, and if I told you all of the good things alone about him, we wouldn't get anything else done. So may I say that he will make the talk for us today, and he will be followed by the other two gentlemen, Mr. Conniff and Mr. Considine, who will answer all of the questions. Mr. Hearst will not answer questions, so keep that in mind when you are preparing your questions to be propounded. This group was initiated in 1955 by Mr. W.R. Hearst, Jr., Frank Conniff, and the late Kingsbury Smith, who comprised the original task force. On a worldwide mission, their news-gathering agency visited Moscow just at as the Red Hierarchy was in an upheaval. Four of the top leaders of the new regime were interviewed: Bogdanin, Zhukov, Molotov, and a rising fellow named Khrushchev. This was the first interview ever granted by the new leadership and was front-paged by every influential newspaper internationally and in all languages. In 1956, the task force received the Pulitzer Prize, and in 1957, with Bob Considine replacing Kingsbury Smith, they visited Moscow to interview Khrushchev. Their reports warned Americans how Russia hoped to win the peace with scientific achievements, especially Sputnik, together with subtle propaganda. At the end of one diatribe, Mr. Hearst replied, and I quote, "I heard every word you said, but I don't believe a word of it." I imagine Mr. Khrushchev was not in the habit of being talked to that way. Their report on Russia, when revisited, won the 1958 Overseas Award. In 1959, the task force was in Moscow with Vice President Nixon on a tour of the American National Exhibition. In 1960, the task force visited Latin America, exposing in Hearst publications the problems and issues troubling our southern neighbors. The most recent trip of the task force was in 1962, December 62, which took it to Bonn, London, Paris, Moscow, and New Delhi, where they again probed into the issues and backgrounds that shape world events. All three Hearst Task Force members covered world beats as individuals and as a team. Mr. Considine was the winner of the 1962 Overseas Press Club Award, and for the series on We Can Bury You, in which Mr. Kay based his information to that extent upon a worldwide survey of America's defenses. Can the world look in 1963 with hope or with pessimism? Did the Cuban incident mark a turning point in the East-West peaceful coexistence? To feel the global pulse, the prize-winning Hearst team, W.R. Hearst, Jr., Frank Conniff, and Bob Considine traveled 30,000 miles on a fact-finding mission to Europe and Asia. Now they report what they heard from the heads of state, military leaders, diplomats, and the man in the street. It is now my pleasure to present Mr. William R. Hearst, Jr., who will deliver his address to you. Mr. Hearst.
Here we go again. Dr. Callison, honored guest and gentleman of the Commonwealth Club. I learned most of my arithmetic out here at Berkeley High School and Hitchcock Military Academy, and then a little tour of A to Z to polish it up a little bit, and then California, which is why I had difficulty figuring whether this was the third or the fourth time that we'd been here, because I didn't get very far. As your chairman has told you, it's Frank Conniff and Bob Considine and myself this year. The Kingsbury Smith, incidentally, is not the late Kingsbury Smith. He's just publishing the Journal American, which isn't going to press, so you can... It's understandable that you might think he's not in existence himself. He just isn't... He's become a publisher instead of a reporter. We stick to this repertorial racket because it beats the hell out of staying home, to tell you the truth, in an office. And we have an awful lot more fun. There's a table here that knows what I'm saying is right because they're all a bunch of guys I went to school with. It's different coming here. It's really like more like coming home because I did go to school here, and I know that if I louse anything up, I'm going to get a big yak from this one bunch over here. If I'm a little nervous now, as you can tell, I was real scared the first time I took this bunch on because it was just like coming back. But I must say I feel a little more confident today because some of the conclusions which we then uttered with a little trepidation have since turned out to have been substantiated over the years. Right. How's that? Any better? I can't see anything now, but it's better, which you can... this is going to be one of the most cross-eyed speakers you ever listen to. Anyhow, better, huh? A few of you, anyway, who may remember back in 55... at a time when the very highly qualified many experts on the Kremlin were predicting a return to Stalinist harshness after 2 years of mildness under Malenkov, we concluded from our own observations on the first trip that the new rulers of Russia would not dare risk a nuclear war. And that was the name of the new kind of war game that they and we knew how to play. Before this same club at that first meeting 8 years ago, I said, to quote my favorite author, "They know, the Russians, that the chance of emerging victorious from a nuclear conflict with the United States would be a very slight one indeed. They know the chance of being wiped out with their entire system would be very great indeed. As long as they know that they themselves cannot attack without the certainty of swift and terrible retaliation, I seriously doubt that they will precipitate a conflict with the West. That's us. I have never varied in my belief in the intervening years. I think recent events in Cuba prove the correctness of that analysis. And speaking of Cuba, I ventured a few thoughts on the subject last September. This is my good side. Last September, several weeks before the October showdown came along down at White Sulphur, we had noticed that many influential columnists and commentators in Washington were pushing the line that we couldn't blockade the island because Webster's definition in his dictionary defines a blockade as an act of war. And there are a lot of very, very tender, frightened people in Washington that give advice. I pointed out in a speech at Hot Springs that weekend that Uncle Sam was shackling himself with legalisms and semantics in an era when it is clearly apparent that Khrushchev makes no pretense of legality except when it suits his own purpose. The exact course dictated by Marxist dogma and executed so faithfully in the past by Lenin and Stalin. I'm just going to quote a paragraph from that speech, and you'll notice that it was in the past. It's in the past tense because I thought that the president was not going to do it. I thought he'd considered a blockade of a sort and had given it up because we were so long in getting around to it. What I'm trying to get across is a quote. Is that we should have put in an effective blockade and never once referred to it as a blockade. We could have found words to explain what we were doing, such as protecting the security of the Western Hemisphere, invoking the Monroe Doctrine or some such pious pap, and avoided any reference to the word blockade. That's the end of that. Well, the record shows that President Kennedy did exactly that eventually. He called it, as if you recall, a quarantine. And Chairman Khrushchev soon discovered that a blockade by any other name can be just as tough when backed by the power and might of an aroused USA. While I thought President Kennedy should have acted when those 61 arms-laden ships and 5,000 Russian technicians first moved into the Caribbean earlier last summer, the president waited until a photograph taken by one of our U-2s disclosed that the risky Russians had begun building offensive missiles right under our very noses. In either case, the result would have been the same. And Chairman Khrushchev would have backed down as gracefully as he could, and as he did. The Hearst Task Force has been going abroad for the past 6 years now in search of news and background information, starting with that first visit in January 55. That won us the Pulitzer Prize, as your chairman has told you, and of the four guys we saw at that time, Bulganin, Zhukov, Marshal Zhukov, and Molotov, only one is left, Khrushchev. They're all changed now to his people. Now we are back from the latest one. It was a 30,000-mile trip that took us all the way out through Moscow, the capitals of Europe, and out to New Delhi and back in India. We decided to make a year-end fact-finding tour when it became apparent that the Cuban crisis marked one of those rare turning points in the balance of world power. On the basis of our investigations, we are able and pleased to report that the United States entered the new year, 1963, on the crest of world prestige and respect unmatched since the glittering atomic era following World War II. Only a few smudges blur the picture of a resolute America determined and capable of maintaining its position as the globe's foremost military and economic power. Is this coming out all right over there? Okay. It's coming out the way it goes in anyway. It's not all right. Unlike the most analyses of a complex world gripped in historical crises, the reason for Uncle Sam's restored eminence can be summarized with classic simplicity in one word, Cuba. When President Kennedy and Chairman Khrushchev stood at high noon in that showdown, October week, the bitter grapple between the free and communist systems reached a crossroad in history. When their fateful confrontation resulted in a Khrushchev backdown, the tide of prestige and the image of power so carefully nourished by the chairman since his Sputniks flared into space began to recede. The watchful world, and that means, okay, slower. And that means a lot. Well, it's longer than I thought. The watchful world, and that means the whole bunch, our allies, the non-aligned nations, and the communists themselves, knew that President Kennedy had won not only a personal duel, but a pivotal Cold War victory. From the Kremlin's point of view, Khrushchev managed his retreat skillfully, even brilliantly. He had been caught out, gambling on continued administration reluctance to face up to the Cuban challenge. The tough old man chose a peaceful solution rather than to risk nuclear war. But the propaganda platitudes emanating from Moscow to explain away his embarrassment fooled no one, I don't think. The whole world got the message that young Mr. Kennedy was a tough man in a clutch. On this trip, we interviewed some of the ranking figures fashioning contemporary history. We had long talks in Bonn with both Chancellor Adenauer and his heir apparent and that economic genius, Ludwig Erhard, who put Germany back on its feet after complete devastation. We probed Prime Minister Nehru out in New Delhi for a little better than an hour in his richly adorned quarters out there. And we talked with General Lyman Limnitzer, who used to be out in Japan for us, the new man of shape. He was a former chief of staff, too. Not to mention ambassadors in London, Paris, New Delhi, and their articulate, informed, and helpful staff specialists. From such a welter of facts and speculation emerges the pattern of a world in crisis, with Cuba as not the only soft spot where the free and communist systems rub restively against one another. Then, too, there are wars within wars, the Sino-Soviet ideological clash, at which we got a real close look in Moscow and New Delhi, is potentially the most explosive story in the world today. The Indo-Chinese border was the Indo-Chinese border war also seized with unchartable possibilities. At least one world statesman, Adenauer, thinks that the Chinese will resume their offensive this spring again, just waiting for over the winter, because, brother, it's cold up there. To match the built-in communist disputes, the free world is veined with ugly streaks of internal tensions of its own. No matter how logical the American position may seem to us, Washington is failing somehow to communicate its rightness to our principal allies. Titans like Germany's Adenauer and France's de Gaulle do not read our strategical and nuclear conceptions. Or if they do, They choose to ignore our wisdom and stubbornly cling to programs of their own. It must be acknowledged that many Americans in Europe, including some diplomats and generals, sympathize with the European stance. Then there is that nice little case of bloodletting known as Britain's attempt to get tapped for membership in the European common market, and the tidy but deadly vendetta between Konrad Adenauer and the man nominated as most likely to succeed him, his one-time close friend, Earhart, Dr. Earhart. Well, we've got some dandy feuds of our own spilling gore in the hallowed halls of the Western Alliance, but there is this difference from those wrenching the commies. We will probably solve ours, one way or another. We have been allies for a long time. We are people of goodwill. We know or think we're positive where what side the right's on, and so we figure the best way to do it is to get along. These other two fellas out there in the Far East know. But at this point, no seer in his right mind could possibly project an accurate line on the outcome of their rivalry, marked by the personal hatred of Khrushchev and Mao Zedong, each one of them figuring himself to be the heir apparent to Stalin. The atmosphere in Moscow a month ago was diametrically different from the festive mood prevailing on previous visits when we caught the Kremlin on upbeat, sparked by some remarkable communist success. Jubilation was the key and expansiveness the tone of the Kremlin bigs then, as they talked of their inevitable triumph in the story in the struggle of competitive coexistence. Khrushchev, clearly the master of the communist apparatus, was always particularly buoyant and bubbly. No such exhilaration could be discerned on the Moscow scene this past December. We felt a switch in style, first of all, on a personal level. Admittedly, we had received the red carpet treatment on earlier visits. Cocky and buoyed by his belief in ancient Marxist claptrap, Khrushchev welcomed us always and welcomed all and any questions that we could think up. We saw no one of stature on this last go-round. Khrushchev and the Kremlin just aren't talking to nosy reporters who bear down hard on sensitive subjects painful to the communist ears, such as Cuba and things like that, or anything that rhymes with Cuba. The lower echelons of the communist bureaucracy, which is where the essence of Stalinism survives, apparently got sadistic kicks from denying us the rudimentary privileges of foreign correspondents. We were not even allowed to cable or broadcast. What had happened to change the climate? The lights burned brightly each night in the Kremlin as we gazed at the old red-walled citadel from our rooms in the Tsarist Vintage National Hotel across the square. But the aura of menace and power seemed to be somewhat dimmed. Again, the answer can be simplified: Cuba. This is patently a time of agonizing reappraisal as Khrushchev and his top commissars huddle around and plot the next bend in the party line. Just as clearly, the new line hasn't yet gelled. It hasn't taken form. Only time can build scar tissue over the wealth and communist prestige gouged by Cuba, just as the rape of Hungary is no longer held against Russia in polite circles with the passage of time. Witness the lapse of the Hungarian issue from the conscience of mankind at the UN. President Kennedy's readiness to march over the brink if necessary to defend the vital interests of the United States demolished several misconceptions which had been growing in the Kremlin. Their growth was abetted by the administration's willingness to believe the best about communist intentions in Cuba earlier. The president himself insisted several times that Russian and Czech weapons to Cuba were merely defensive, if you recall. Lulled by this attitude, Khrushchev took the next logical step in probing what must have appeared to every Kremlin strategist as sheer American softness. They had to find out, and they did. Khrushchev had been backpedaling ever since, but it is doubtful if any Red Army marshal or party theoretician has voiced criticism of his Caribbean strategy. Will the next thrust come in Berlin? On one point, all observers queried by the task force in Moscow and other points agreed. The Kremlin is now doing its homework on old Kennedy statements, promises, and pledges to the beleaguered city of Berlin. They assessed them wrong once, and they don't want to do it again. Since 55, and our first run-in with this fella, the Hearst task force has repeated time without number the unqualified statement that Khrushchev would avoid a nuclear showdown at almost any cost. None of his actions then, spiced by recurrent lapses into threats, bluster, and belligerence, has caused us in any way to alter our fundamental judgment. Or since then. Every old Moscow hand concurs in the estimate now that Khrushchev's grip on the party apparatus is more secure than ever. Cuba has not shaken this hold one bit. All the new men coming along in recent Kremlin shake-ups or shake-outs are indisputably his men. The idea that the Red Army brass, typified by that scowling Marshal Malinovsky, could exert pressure on Chairman Khrushchev brings disbelieving head-shaking from informed Westerners in Moscow. It also shows an ingrained inability to understand how completely the communist apparatus controls every facet of activity in this strange, brooding country. The party that handles such Red Army luminaries as Trotsky, Beria, and Zhukov will have little trouble fielding any complaints from the present crop of marshals and admirals appointed by these very same people. Likewise dying hard, but surely, is the notion that a clique of Stalinists maintains veto power over Khrushchev. Matter of fact, practically the entire top rank in the Kremlin consists of old Stalinists. Khrushchev, Mikoyan, Shuzhlov, Shvernik, and all. At Al, it says here, and I don't know who Al is, to tell you the truth. Then try and name one who isn't a direct legacy from Stalin's period or who doesn't owe his protection to a relic from that era. They're Stalinists, all right, but they're only there because Khrushchev puts up with them. The current leaders are steeped in Stalinism, but desperately desire to purge themselves of the old man's memory of terror and tragedy. I've concentrated so much on this subject of Russia because we have long realized that it is of paramount interest to more people than any other topic. On the last trip, we ran across many other developments of absorbing concern to us, such as the rift in the commie camp, the growing rift, and the controversy in Europe over the common market, largely touched off by the strange behavior of de Gaulle. Only in Moscow did we comprehend the deep cleavage between Khrushchev and Mao Zedong, two elderly hardheads, who believe that anyone who deviates from his personal roadmap to world dominion is some kind of a communist nut or something. At the time we visited Moscow in December, American and British personnel on station there predicted that the family quarrel would soon erupt into the open. Both sides are jockeying now to force the other into making the first break and making the big public break. The one which first openly denounces the opposition can be pilloried as the side responsible for splintering a supposedly monolithic movement. The Russian communists are sick and tired of being told by their junior partners that Khrushchev's program of peaceful coexistence directly contradicts the sainted tenets of Marx and Lenin. On the surface, however, Moscow still blandly presents the image of the indulgent uncle who understands the tantrums of a willful nephew. After all, uncle cut a caper or two in his youth. Also. Now, how long Khrushchev, with his low boiling point and quick-flaring temper, can maintain this posture in the face of what must be intolerable provocation, provides a guessing game for Westerners. No more. What came as somewhat of a surprise to us, although it's well understood by American Ambassador Foy Kohler and his capable staff, is the lack of leverage Khrushchev possesses on his recalcitrant ally. We had assumed that the Russians sat at the master switch in Moscow, ready to turn the spigot of supplies on or off as if his ambitious little chums gave him too much lip or trouble. Not so, we were told. With the withdrawal of Soviet teams of technicians some time back, and the abandonment of many joint Sino-Soviet projects, the muscle in Russia's economic pressures tapered off considerably. Only oil for the camps of China remains in Khrushchev's arsenal of intimidation. By Western estimates, Russia still supplies about 40% of China's oil. The Chinese used thousands of fuel-eating trucks in the border war. Guesses ran from 10 to 25,000. But they managed to bulldoze Nehru and nail down thousands of square miles of real estate without flying a single combat mission. And the reason I make that point is because airplanes need these bases and they can't follow along an airplane like they can the Army. They have to be spotted around. So they just did without them. Oddly enough, neither did the Indian Air Force fly a single combat mission. So while it may have been one of the coldest wars, it was one of the strangest ones, too, that ran on there for about a month. Most intriguing to criminologists based in Moscow is the uncomfortable corner the Chinese have the Russians backed into in the matter of straight orthodoxy. Quite clearly, the pragmatic Mr. Khrushchev has tailored the hoary old Marxist maxims to the realities of the nuclear age. War is out. I don't say permanently, but I mean it's out as a get-going Charlie move. I mean, to just move anybody quickly. The Chinese comrades lament that the chairman is failing to carry the assault to the imperialist bastions when the book, a la Marx, flatly states that capitalism is a decadent husk ready to fall over anyway. Why build up bourgeois states like the newly emerging nations when they should be allowed to wallow in poverty, hasten the arrival of the proletariat as a political force, and thus heat up the climate for revolution? That's the Chinese view. The fiery go-the-limit philosophy of Peking inevitably has a deep appeal for younger Marxists throughout the world who pant for a hurry-up revolution so they can deep-fry the hated capitalists. Now, switching back to Europe, we find the headlines crowded these days with words like Polaris, Skybolt, Counterforce, multilateral nuclear forces, common market, and such. Each question is extremely involved, and I'm certainly not going to try and clarify them with this limited time. But the growing unity, if I could, which I couldn't, but the growing unity of Europe is one of the great political phenomenons of our time. And it would be wise to follow its development very, very closely. I say this in spite of the stories of recent weeks, especially those relating to our troubles with de Gaulle. The President of France is a tough and cantankerous guy, and many of his moves baffle me entirely. But he is dedicated to the resurgence of France as a world power, and no one can criticize him for this patriotic impulse. Sometimes, though, it seems to, and I'm sure it does to President Kennedy and to us, that de Gaulle is unable to see that France's lasting welfare lies in subordinating its own narrow interests to the greater good of a united Europe and of the Western alliance, in which his country will play a deservedly large role. Needless to say, he's not long on gratitude either, but then I guess that doesn't run with politicians too much, anywho. For I repeat and emphasize, the growing cohesion of Europe is one of the greatest historical movements of our century, and for several centuries. And I do not think that even as formidable a roadblock as General de Gaulle is going to deflect its momentum for long. As a matter of fact, it seems certain that the French president has the unity of Europe as his ultimate goal, except that he wants it on his own terms. The news we read these days represent, I think, the growing pains of the developing continent. It is even likely to get worse before it gets better, because so many bugs actually still remain in the blueprint. But history shows that once a great movement of this kind gets underway, it's a very difficult thing to slow down or stop. And the events that could halt this trend would be bad news for the United States, too. The rebirth of balance of power politics, the revival of nationalism, strict nationalism, or the return of the economic rivalries between the European powers. All in all, this most recent journey was rather reassuring. I can only hope that our president and his administration draw the proper conclusions from the Cuban crisis, which changes every day. All you have to do is read the paper. Or the Examiner, I mean, that is. I can only hope that in a showdown, American strength and unity proved more than a match for the bluster and bravado of communist Russia, and that we learned that lesson. Let us hope there will be no return to the soft-headed notion that communism can be diverted from its ultimate goal of world conquest by our own wishful thinking and willingness to believe communist promises. The shocks and pressures of the near future can almost be sensed by all of us who recognize that we live in this era of continual crisis. The protracted conflict between the free and the communist worlds will probably last beyond the lifetime of any one of us here in the room. And the events which we are now witnessing will go a long way toward determining the outcome of the eventual grinding and implacable struggle. The road ahead is dark and perilous, and the future can only be dimly seen by the best crystal ball artists. But we must persevere in our quest for a world peace that will be meaningful and enduring, not just a temporary settlement. All over the world, events are on the march, and one way or another, their outcome will affect us all. We must move forward into the future, confident of our God-given strength and firm in the belief that the American nation possesses that moral and material fiber needed to meet the challenges that inevitably are coming. We must convince the world not of our righteousness, self-righteousness, but of our sense of right for ourselves and for them, a sense of right that holds out to the emerging nations of the world a pattern and formula for the good and abundant life that we have fashioned here on our own continent for them. And we shouldn't sell it so much as we should just tell it. Tell the world of our freedoms, how they help shape a finer existence and a better world for all who enjoy them. Project our story to the world in such a way that some of its burning wonder and majesty will rub off on those who even now are striving to take the first tentative steps towards liberty. This is a challenge on which we can all participate and contribute, each in his own capacity, that extra bit of effort required to defeat the hard, unending, relentless, atheistic drive of Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev. And with God's help, and sustained by our own faith, I don't think there can be but one outcome to this struggle. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hurst. And we now come to the question and answer period. These will be taken care of by Mr. Considine and Mr. Conniff. I know that you know a great deal about these two gentlemen, so I shall make this rather short in introducing or presenting them, rather. Bob Considine was born in Washington, D.C., and attended Georgetown University and started with the Washington Post as sports and drama writer. He is married, has two sons and two daughters. After 3 or 4 years with the Post, he joined the Washington Herald as sports editor, editorial, and feature writer. Later, he became a syndicated sports columnist for the New York American, transferred to the International News Service as a war correspondent in England, and through the China War and the Korean War, and he was with MacArthur in Korea, and he has written, among other things, such diverse works as, quote, MacArthur, the Magnificent, end quote, and, quote, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, and the Babe Ruth story, and so forth. Mr. Frank Conniff, the gentleman next to Mr. Hurst, of the three speakers, takes the championship on the baby marathon. He has four boys and one girl. He's out ahead of the others in that regard. Fortunate man. He attended the University of Virginia and participated in varsity football and boxing. And he started writing the sports column for the Danbury News Service and joined the New York Journal American. And he, too, was a combat correspondent in Africa, Italy, Germany, and finally in Korea. And after World War II, he started in as a writing humor and special columns for the New York publications. When with General MacArthur, he was relieved of his command. He was with MacArthur when he was relieved of his command. Mr. Conniff was covering the Chinese communist situation when he returned to this country with General MacArthur. He has been with Mr. William Randolph Hearst, Jr. as a member of the original Hearst Task Force, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Now, gentlemen, if you will kindly step over here to the microphone with me, we will see what we can do with a bunch of these questions. There's a lot more here, I'm sure, than we can get around to answering. So you folks take them as you see fit. There's a whole lot of them on Cuba. I'll read some of them, and you can take them from there. The first one is, in view of today's report that quite likely some atomic installations remain in Cuba, should we not insist on inspection? Another one along the same line is, what should we do about a bomb buildup of arms in Cuba? And the Russian troops already in Cuba. And what about the red buildup in Cuba? A lot of them along that line. So
it all depends on who said there is a red buildup in Cuba. I think that We're keeping a pretty good eye on it. I think the CIA is better than it has been. I think our U-2 and our low-level reconnaissance planes are keeping very good tabs on excavations and movements of troops and so-called experts. We're getting some pretty good reports, but not very good from refugees. As for the fact that there are atomic weapons, well, we don't know, really. There's no reason for no reason to go in there and bombard Cuba on a mere report. I think the policy of the Kennedy administration is to economically squeeze Castro off his throne. I think it'll take a little time. I think he's stronger than all of us believe he is. It'll take a little doing. And as for demanding inspection, I think eventually we're going to get inspection there. But it can't be forced at this time unless we're prepared to go in there and kick him around. And I don't think that's our policy, and I don't think at this particular time it would do us any particular good.
Along the same order while we're on Cuba are the following. Do you think there were secret terms involved in the Soviet missile withdrawal in Cuba? And another as follows. Do you still believe that President Kennedy won over Soviet dictator in the light of the continuing buildup and war preparations in Cuba now?
I don't believe there's anyone here, certainly us, who can give an answer to the first question. And I think that President Kennedy clearly won over Prime Minister Chairman Khrushchev in that exchange. Now, I think in Mr. Hearst's speech, the most important thing is the growth of complacency that could possibly derive from thinking we had humiliated Chairman Khrushchev. The communist policy makes allowances for these defeats. I think Lenin had one of his most famous theses was one step backward and two step forward. Now, they have run into a temporary setback down there. It was interesting to us in Moscow to observe that no Russians apparently believed, this is the ordinary people we talk to, that they had taken a defeat down there. They have a controlled press. They only print what they want. And Chairman Khrushchev has been presented to the Russian and captive nations audience as the man who saved the peace. Now, they know on the top echelon that they weren't quite up to the ultimate decision for nuclear war. We don't think they're ever going to be up to it, because it would always with the condition that we maintain our strength at more than parity. And Khrushchev knows it clearly. The rest of the world knows it. But there's kind of a growth in Washington, I believe, to take things to bask in this one triumph that is merely a battle along this continuing war that will go on perhaps for 100 years between the free and communist worlds. And we didn't press home the on-site inspection, but I really thought there was one advantage in that. For one thing, I never thought Russia would consent to it. Secondly, the advantage is that we weren't forced to give our no invasion pledge. We still have liberty of movement down there. As witness, these headlines of today are very disturbing, and I am reassured by the way the Latin American Committee of the Senate is demanding an immediate briefing from the State Department, which I think will bring forth some facts on which we can base a more durable judgment.
In the event that you didn't all hear the introduction of these speakers, the gentleman to my right is Mr. Kniff, and the gentleman to my left is Mr. Considine, to identify them. Further, I think you all know him anyway. They crossed me up by changing places. Now we take a little different tack on this one in regard to Cuba and so forth, and a different viewpoint, and it is, how do we convince the neutral nations that communist bases in China are any different from U.S. bases in Turkey, England, Spain, and so forth?
I think this is more Considine's answer, but I'll take it. How do we convince the neutral nations communist USR bases in Cuba are any different from U.S. bases in Turkey, England, Spain? Khrushchev asked that impertinent question of William Randolph Hearst, Jr. once, and got a most impertinent answer. Bill's point was that we bear no malice, we mean no harm. We're there to defend a sovereign territory, not to expand our imperialism. I think that comes down to the word motive. We have no motives against the countries bordering on Turkey and England and Spain. And Khrushchev, in his furtive and clandestine way, certainly had motives against our side of the world.
This follows a line that we've already answered, I think. It is, at the recent communist meeting in East Berlin, Khrushchev bragged about the victory. He said, we still have our bombs, and the United States guarantees the continuance of a communist state in Cuba. How can this be considered an American victory?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say we never should accept Chairman Khrushchev's evaluation of the world situation on its face value. There was another part of that speech, you remember, where he stressed to the communist world there assembled the enormous might of the United States, the ability to rain 40,000 warheads onto Russia and the captive nations. He's fighting a polemical duel with his Chinese comrades, and I think it's a reflection of Chairman Khrushchev's feeling that Cuba is a continuing thing. It goes back to the statement I made a few minutes ago, I hope, and think, that they make allowances for retreats. They are obviously going to form up. They do have this foothold in the Western Hemisphere. It's still only 90 miles from Florida. They have had to strip certain amount of armament, the big weapons, out of there. But in the Khrushchev view and the communist view, they are figuring out a new approach. They will watch for American softness again. They'll watch the American political scene. And eventually, they will use Cuba in a different way. They may use it just as a base for espionage. They may use it for propaganda purposes and within their own empire and to the rest of the world. It's to me, again, to repeat the statement, that there is no place for complacency about the October victory down there, which was clearly an American victory, because this is a running sore. Khrushchev is rearranging his approach to it, and we will have Cuba in the news for many months, if not years to come. I'd like to say in passing that it's very interesting as reporters to come and talk to this group and listen to the questions, because it again stresses and brings home to us the deep interest of so many people in Cuba. We might be perhaps just back from Europe, a little more bemused by the state of de Gaulle's relations with Germany or the Indochina border war, which, of course, are great issues. But coming here and learning of the preoccupation with Cuba, I'm sure, is a very beneficial for us, because it will enable us to know that the public is keeping its eye on it in a very concentrated fashion.
Thank you, Mr. Kniff. We'll leave Cuba for a moment and hop over to India. And the first one is, what is Nehru really, what is Nehru's really like, or what's he really like? Does he truly appreciate the recent aid, or feel that the help from us is for our own benefit? And the second one is, will Krishna Memnon succeed Nehru as Premier of India?
Gee, let me get that one. Ugh. Oh. What is Nehru like? He's a great deal like Jack Parr. Does he truly appreciate our recent aid? Appreciate is quite not quite the word. He's relieved by it, I think. He can eat now regularly. We found him just a little chastened, and the only reason we knew he was, he nodded to us. It's like somebody's lying on Charles de Gaulle, who's come down with a terrible case of inferiority complex. Now he believes he's only Napoleon. But Nehru, we had a good session with Nehru. We sat there stupefied by some of his replies. For example, we said, in view of the fact that these erstwhile friends of yours, the Chinese Reds, have clobbered you, taken a land equal to West Virginia, and almost as bad. It's a bad land. That sent them whimpering back across the border, or nearly to it. Anyway, in view of that, would you still propose them or second them for membership in the United Nations? And the guy said immediately, sure, certainly. And Hearst said what I thought was a rather alarming thing. We looked around for an exit. He said, that's like asking a fellow who's just committed rape on the second floor of your palace here to come downstairs and join a polite ladies' card party. Well, there have been bigger laughs from the Prime Minister, I'd say, than that. He's grateful, I guess. Between the United States and Britain, we've given him $30 million in small arms and medicine supplies. We probably would go in there with fighter planes if they tried to knock those C-130s of ours down. And so would the British. We ask him, does that mean that you're aligned now, or do you still feel that you're neutral and unaligned? And he said, certainly, we've never been neutral, he said. A neutral is someone who cares nothing, has no emotion about what's going on around him. India cares deeply for everything. Unaligned, yes, we're militarily unaligned. We don't think that we owe you anything, $30 million. And so what about Russia? Is going to give you some jets? What's six jets? He's as unaligned as he can be, and will remain unaligned until they come over the mountain again in the spring, as they might. Will Krishna Menon succeed Nehru as Premier of India? God forbid.
Well, let's jump up to Red China for a minute and take two short ones over there. First one is, does Communist China seek world dominations? And the next is, must we not admit Red China to the United Nations if only for, quote, controls, end quote, of atomic bomb when and if they get it?
Well, I think communist leaders are all in China, are all dedicated communists, believers in Marxism, and at this point, fanatical believers in it, unlike the more sophisticated Russians. What they are doing is, according to Marxist theory, they are attempting first to seize control of the communist world, the communist nations, and guide the philosophy towards the ultimate showdown with the Western world, which they are confident they will win. This idea that you can't control China and its rearmament unless you bring them into the United Nations, I don't think is really holds water, because that Russia acts pretty well the way it wants to, despite the United Nations, and I'm sure Red China would too. Also, we are so far advanced in our weaponry, so is Soviet Russia, that a rudimentary atomic bomb would present no threat to the world for quite a long time to come. And that relates also to de Gaulle's argument that he's developing a small little device that by our standards is like the Model T compared to the most advanced piece of automotive engine. Any advertisers I should plug, Charlie? I don't think either France or China, as atomic powers, nuclear powers, will be rated very highly for a long while to come.
I want to jump around a little and take a sampling from all of these, and this it comes back to our own country and what it does. Did we make a secret deal to remove the missiles from Turkey?
No, we're just putting in some better ones.
And this, is there any truth to the rumor that the Kennedy family and their interests have bought a substantial interest in any or all of the Hearst Enterprises?
If they did, the Kennedy family would be the first to let you know, I'm afraid.
Gentlemen, on that note, we will extend the sincere thanks of the Commonwealth Club of California to the Hearst Task Force, and we stand adjourned.